You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's weekly show about the world of comics. In this week's show, concluding our month of shows looking at newspaper comics, I'm talking to writers of strips based on beloved British characters. Later in the show, I'll be talking to Hugh J. Davies, a comic book writer and artist who was involved in the Mirror newspaper's attempt to relaunch their classic strip Garth as a serial on their website, which following creative differences led to Hugh republishing his work on Garth as the graphic novel Freeman. However, before that, I'm talking to Richie K. Chandler, one of a team of writers who pens the continuing adventures of Wallace and Gromit, Monday to Saturday in the pages of the Sun newspaper. Continuing the aural travels around the world that listeners have experienced on my show this month, and following my chat with Carrie Fransman in the British Library, and my transatlantic phone call with Audrey Neffenegger in Chicago, my interview with Richie was recorded next to the London Eye, on the south bank of the River Thames, so you'll have to forgive the background noise. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to Richie K. Chandler, one of the contributors to the daily Wallace and Gromit strip in The Sun. You told me that you've done 11 or 10 weeks' worth of the strip since last summer. How did you first get the gig?
It was a pleasant surprise, really. I'd done one story a couple of years ago when Titan were producing the Wallace and Gromit comic, an actual kids comic. I ended up getting that just through meeting the Titan crew at a... I think it was Bristol comic show. And
they're doing a portfolio session.
Yeah, that's right. And I showed them a self-published comic book I'd done called Delicate Axiom, which is very unlike Wallace and Gromit. But, you know, just showing that I had some interest in writing, really. And through that conversation, I pitched some ideas for the Wallace and Gromit comic. Fortunately, I got one story was accepted and was produced, but unfortunately, it ended up being in the final issue of that comic as it all folded after that. So that was a bit frustrating because I'd done a lot of, you know, obviously I knew the characters, but I'd done a lot of research, you know, really getting to know the characters in the hope that I'd, you know, be able to write a lot of stories for the for that comic. But then that all came into good use because a couple of years later I got an email from Titan asking if I could pitch some ideas for this new newspaper strip they're producing, which I understand came about from some success they had with, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I believe this came from doing a digital release of some of the strips they'd done from the comic, or some sort of Wallace and Gromit strips in a digital format. So they ended up doing this weekly newspaper strip published in The Sun. Initially they asked me to pitch some ideas and stories. That's how it all got going, really.
And in fact, if listeners to the show rush out tomorrow and buy The Sun on Friday and Saturday, you're actually writing this week's strip, which is called Paper Hound.
Yes, well, yes. I mean, there is a team. There's a team of writers that are involved on each strip. I think sometimes I've pitched ideas from scratch, and then they've been bounced around and changed, and then come back, and I've sort of done a final draft of a script, and then even then, I think it goes through. You know, it's seen by a lot of people. It's I suppose it's much like a sort of movie script in Hollywood. There's a lot of back and forth, but you know, this is Go on, sorry.
And presumably some of those people actually work at Aardman, so that it's, you know, in keeping with the characters.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the key things, is that Aardman have a very specific idea of what they want the characters to be doing. And Titan are very aware of that, so they're trying to keep you in line. So, yeah, there's several stages of sort of filtering where they're checking the script, firstly for things being out of character, and then also just the sort of quality control, making sure that things are funny enough or up to the sort of standard they're looking for, really.
I read about half a dozen weeks' worth of the Wallace and Gromit strip through a collected edition that you can get online from a website called Zinio. Mm-hmm. And it does seem to be retaining a lot of the humour, obviously, of the animated version, including sight gags, puns on existing products. Like in one strip I read, there was Wallace reading a book called The Dog Delusion, which amused me immensely, but wasn't one of yours, unfortunately. Because it will ultimately exist in two versions, one that's serialised over 6 days of the week and one that you could actually see the whole week's worth in one go. Does that mean that when you come to construct the story, you think of it both as a comic that has up to 18 panels and also as a strip that may be only read as an individual instalment?
Yes, in a word. Yeah, sadly that pun wasn't mine. I did do a what was it? The Diary of Spaniel Peeps, which was
good.
I enjoyed. Yeah, there's a lot of punning in there. Big part of the humour. But yeah, in terms of the rhythm of the strip, it's very important that if somebody breaks in the middle of the week, if they pick the paper up on a Wednesday, they should still be able to get something out of the strip. They should still be able to get the humour, and they should know exactly what's going on. Obviously, if they read the whole week's worth, there's a nice arc, there's a nice full story in that. But yeah, that's quite that was a little bit new for me, because coming from the sort of small press background where you've got no one looking over your shoulder for a start, but also you've got fewer restrictions if you're writing a self-published comic book. Whereas in this, things have to be quite tight. You've got very little space for a start, so you can't have any unnecessary words just taking up that precious print space. And also there's a certain rhythm to it, where you've got, usually it's a three-panel strip. The final panel is your punchline. And though obviously you want to have as much humour along the way as possible. Which is very different from a comic strip, where the timing is more like... Sorry, from a comic book, where the timing is more that you will try and have almost like a mini cliffhanger on the end of every page. So every page turn, that's when you get the big sort of... the big sort of thing that moves the story forward. So, yeah, it's a lot of differences there. But, you absolutely have to be very conscious to that. Mm. Strip a day, but 6 day story a week.
Did it take you a while to get into the rhythm of it? Because obviously there are also certain rules you have to follow, such as in the first panel of each day's instalment, if it's from the Tuesday onwards, you have to re-establish the plot of that week's story, but do it in a way that seems naturalistic and not, you know, a massive info dump.
Yeah, well, you said it very well there, completely. I mean, sometimes you can put captions in to sort of set the scene, but even when you're doing that, if you put the caption in with a little pun, you can make that, you know, it's not just it serves as an entertaining purpose as well as just setting the scene. But yeah, I mean, with three panels, there's not a lot of time for setup, so ideally you want to be set up immediately reading the first panel of the strip, so you can put humour in there. It's not just serving as a sort of setup for the ultimate punchline in the third panel.
And having interviewed loads of people who work in regular comics, small press, graphic novels, talking about newspaper strips is something actually that I'm relatively unfamiliar with, because I guess although they're both comics, there's not that much crossover between the two worlds. But you're obviously someone who has had an interest in newspaper strips for a while, as someone who wrote their dissertation on Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah.
So did you always have a great love of humour strips and newspapers?
Yes, but I think as a child I wasn't that conscious of the difference between a newspaper comic strip and a comic book. For one thing, I very rarely read a newspaper strip in an actual newspaper. I would read the Peanuts book collections and later on the Calvin and Hobbes, and you know, so essentially you were picking up a book, you know, much in the same way as I'd be reading, I don't know, a Spider-Man annual. You know, it's just books with comics and stories and pictures. That sort of specific format or that sort of daily feed of comics wasn't really something I picked up on. But certainly as I started to make my own comics and you know, was more aware of the process, you become very conscious of that. And I think now when I'm doing self-published things, at the moment I'm working on something very specifically for the web, I think that's moving back. When people are doing weekly installments or daily installments of things on the web, that's moving back to that idea of you know, having to have a little nugget of entertainment that works by itself, which may take 30 seconds to read a day or a couple of minutes a day. You know, you can also, of course, put a graphic novel online and put a page every week or so, and not particularly worry about having that sort of weekly breakdown, and really see it as sort of feeding the page of a book, which will ultimately, you know, is ultimately focused on being in print. But yeah, I think if you're consciously doing that weekly strip, then it's exactly the same as that sort of little mini installments for a newspaper.
I suppose it must be both rewarding and frustrating seeing the Wallace and Gromit strips you've written in The Sun, because I believe it is the biggest selling newspaper in the UK. It sells about 2 million every day. So you are one of the most widely read comic strip creators in Britain. But at the same time, unless people actually Google who writes Wallace and Gromit, I believe another one of the writers, for example, is the guy who writes the It Came From Dartmoor blog about British classic comics.
Right.
But again, I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't Googled it the other day. So, I don't know, do you see that maybe, I mean, you know, I hope that I help by doing this interview, that having done the Wallace and Gromit strip, it is a massive help for you as a comic book creator, but at the same time, there are these frustrations.
Yeah, it's, I mean, for one thing, it's a help in terms of learning my craft, because when you're working, I work with an editor called Rona Simpson, and it's very good having somebody sort of basically critique your scripts you're sending back, and basically makes you up your game, because you're, you know, as a self-published thing, you can writer, you can be a bit knackered, and you know, you're not always necessarily your hardest critic. Especially if you're, you know, when you're working with your own characters, it's quite hard to sort of step back and see them and see what can be improved. It's quite nice to have somebody saying, this could be funnier, this doesn't work, as well as say, this is really, you know, this is really good and I like this. So it gives you a sense of achievement when you're pleasing the editor. And, you know, occasionally if you send a script in and there's no changes to be made, then, you know, that's very satisfying. As far as the frustration of not getting your name up there, I mean, from a practical point of view, I completely understand that. As I said earlier, while I'm writing the bulk of the script, sometimes it comes from ideas that have been bounced around other people at Titan already. Yeah. Plus, as you suggested, it goes through Aardman. So there's, you know, you couldn't really fit in that little newspaper space all the people that have been involved on the strip.
Yeah, written by pencil, coloured by...
exactly. I mean, the writers alone, there could be, you know, several people on that. So, you know, there's certainly no hard feelings in that. There's also, I mean, that's not really an issue. I mean, certainly it's nice that I can put it on my website and say, you know, I've been involved with this and that, and that's great. But no, I mean, if I had a character that I ended up in a situation where somebody else was writing the strip and I had that control, then I'd certainly be in the same, you know, I'd completely understand. I'd completely want to control that character and make sure that they weren't doing anything that was, you know, out of character. Yeah, so there's not really an issue for me with that.
And when it comes to the science fiction aspects of the strip, Wallace is always creating bizarre contraptions and machines that ultimately go wrong. Do you find it easy to come up with those by the time you've written the end of 1 week's instalments? Have you got a long list of contraptions and robots that you're looking forward to fitting in future instalments?
It depends. I mean, initially I pitched a lot of ideas and a couple of them ended up being used. There was an automatic scarecrow, robot scarecrow, and a few other things. And the problem often is if you focus too much on just what the wacky invention will be, then you can get a little bit repetitive where the strip is. Wallace has problem, invents machine goes crazy, Gromit saves the day. Whereas I think what Titan have done with the newspaper strip is try and it's got a slightly different feel to the sort of more adventurous stories of what was the kids comic and also the cartoons, in that it is more of a sort of domestic situation. It's on a little sitcom, and you know, some of the problems are a little bit smaller rather than, you know, big epic movies, but. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's better to try and deal with comedy from the situation rather than rely solely on, yeah, crazy machines going wrong. But obviously that's still a big part of the flavour of the strip.
Mm. And it rubs shoulders on the page with... I'm not going to mention the erotic CGI drama, more the classic Viking strip, Hagar the Horrible, that runs underneath it. And if you look at other British newspapers that are being published, for example, in The Mirror, they're still publishing The Perishers and Andy Capp. So there still are these classic British humour strips that are being published on a daily basis. But I actually think of Americans as perhaps being better at doing gag strips in newspapers. You know, the ones that you mentioned before, Peanuts, Calvin and Hobbes. Even going back as far as Little Nemo and the one in
Crazy
the
Cat,
Crazy Cat, the one in the swamp that was all about politics.
Pogo,
thank you, by Walt Kelly. You know, I mean, do you see any kind of like Atlantic divide in terms of humour that has a broader appeal? Because a lot of the British ones seem to be very based on British sort of like characteristics, and so they have a lot more local humour rather than universal humour to them.
Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. When you're aiming something in a national newspaper, it makes sense that you've got these sort of, these very, very national identified characters. And it's quite, as you say, a lot of these strips have been running for many years, and it's quite hard to develop new strips for newspapers. And, you know, the fact that Wallace and Gromit were established British icons already obviously helps them fit into that mold. For me as a creator, I'm not very conscious of that either. Again, as a kid when I read Snoopy and things, I wasn't that conscious of, oh, this is American and this is British. I read the Beano, and later I read the Marvel comics, and it was all just comics to me. So I don't know. I mean, from a marketing point of view or from a readership point of view, that may very well be the case, but it's certainly not something I'm so conscious of in what I read. Having said that, one of the key things of Wallace and Gromit as well is the sort of Britishness and Englishness of it. And I think, it's even a sort of Yorkshire, northern-based...
patois.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's something I've got to be conscious of, but as a writer, but it's not something as a fan of comics that I'm so interested in or worried about.
Cool. Thank you very much.
No worries.
If you're listening to this show on the day of broadcast, there are a couple of installments of Ritchie's current Wallace and Gromit storyline, Paper Hound, to be found in this week's copies of The Sun, before he hands the strip over to another member of the writing team next week. You can buy a collection of 12 weeks' worth of Wallace and Gromit strips at gb.zinio.com, and you can find info about Ritchie's comics at www.tempo-1.com. lush.com. Next, here's my interview with Hugh J. Davies about his work in reviving the classic comic strip character Garth for the Daily Mirror, a character who originally appeared in strips in the newspaper from 1943 to 1997, a time-travelling and genre-crossing action hero who can be seen as a predecessor of Michael Moorcock's Eternal Champion, but who never quite reached the status of other classic British comic book and comic strip heroes. Hugh's opinions on British newspapers and comic books are his own, and not representative of myself or Resonance FM. I'm talking to Hugh J. Davies, writer of Freeman, which started out as a version of Garth in the Daily Mirror. And I was wondering if you could actually talk a bit about that, because I read that your history of the involvement in the strip was that they approached you to relaunch Garth in 2007, which is obviously, you know, it's a classic British sci-fi character that people knew and love from the 1960s and 70s, being drawn by people like Frank Bellamy and Peter O'Donnell. And so it is obviously the kind of property that is ripe for reimagining. But I guess you came into some obstacles along the way.
Yeah, a lot of obstacles. Some of the main problems that I faced when I was actually putting the character together, or re-putting the character together, was the fact that, on the whole, people didn't want something to change, and the actual concept needed change. Towards the end of the late 80s, early 90s, it had become a very convoluted story and didn't make much sense. So what I wanted to do was really pitch it right back, even before it started in the 1943. Take it right back before then, set it in the sort of like, you know, 1920s, you know, early 1920s. So it had a much richer feel, more heritage to it, more of a Jules Verneian action adventure, and you know, give it some real history. The styles and the designs I originally went in with are very different from the designs that I ended up drawing, because the restrictions that they gave me for the online site were incredible. I wasn't allowed to use this color, I wasn't allowed to have that and do this. I mean, it went on and on. Originally, I wanted to do a black and white strip, very much like it originally was, and I've still got a lot of that artwork. We had to literally redraw those pages and turn them into full page strips. When I suggested color, I wanted proper full on color. And they were a little bit reticent about that to start off with. However, the first story, which was 67 pages long, took Garth into, I suppose you could call it, a wasteland, a tundra of snow and ice. It had Viking mythology in it, and histories and all sorts of things, like even a giant dragon type thing. And one of the interesting aspects of it was that I used very few colors in the actual artwork itself, trying to give it more of a monotone sort of feel. You know, sort of like, I suppose it would be a bit like, you know, when stereo came out in the late 60s, you know, you had, before that you had mono, and it was kind of like that. Moving into the second story, though, I really felt that there was a real need for a much more colorful feel to it, especially as it was going into 1920s New York City. And we again flat colored it. There was very little shading. It was all done by our illustrator. I started pushing the limits with the lines, even though they told me they wanted it to be a little bit starker, and started pushing it towards where I wanted it to go. However, about halfway through the second story, there were a couple of things that happened, and the book had to change completely. I had to take the assets and rebrand them, and they became Captain Garth Freeman of the Armed Services, and basically self-publish it, which I did, and then Marcosia took up the publishing of the graphic novel, which was collecting the first and the second story, and a lot of nice Easter eggs in the back as well, which had sort of, you know, sort of like artwork, why we did this, why we drew that, so it was fun.
When it came to the serialized version, though, was it the equivalent of a newspaper strip online, that it would be the same amount of material that they release on a daily basis, or was it more of a weekly strip?
It was meant to be a page every day.
Right.
And I provided them up front with more than a page every day. You know, I was working ahead on a project, so they had everything ahead of time. However, I kept coming into problems. I'd get a phone call saying, you know, I'd find out that the artwork hadn't been uploaded. So people were like, well, where's the next page?
Mm.
And I provided like 2 weeks worth to the Daily Mirror. So it was like, oh God, you know, why haven't you put the artwork up? So I'd make a phone call and I'd end up having to go down to Canary Wharf, go into the offices myself and upload the pages, which was crazy, really, really crazy. In the end, that's why I moved it over to my ebook platform.
Mm.
So it had a direct link from the Daily Mirror and we went and set up a link again. I had to go in and set the link up. You know, for a very forward-thinking newspaper, they didn't really seem to be very much on the ball. Mm. And maybe it's because to them it was a property that didn't really have much that they were interested in. You know, it had been dropped in the 90s. They were more interested in doing pop stars and that type of thing. And, you know, even though they were talking about let's relaunch it and let's do this, and I think their interest was very nominal, because there was a lot of people out there who wanted to see Garth come back.
Hmm.
So the editor at the time, Ken Layson, was very passionate about the character, and myself and him actually the whole reason I ended up doing the relaunch actually goes back to 2002.
Hmm.
Where Ken and I had originally had a long conversation in a local pub that he used to frequent every dinner time, and there was this running sort of conversation between us for about 3 or 4 years, and unfortunately Ken decided to fall off a zip wire and hurt himself very badly, and at that point they brought in a guy that basically had no concept of the history of the character or anything else. There was also interest to redo the script from a CG point of view from a certain Mr. Nash over at The Sun, and he kind of stuck the knife in from behind a little bit. It was a bit of an old boys network thing. So what happened was that the whole thing became this little political bomb, and basically it just became ridiculous because nothing was getting done. Nobody seemed to be as interested in the end as I was. And I was doing all the work, and we were meant to be getting it back in the paper, and suddenly it wasn't going back in the paper. And I was like, okay. So that's when I took the property and did something fresh with it, really. However, later on, people are still saying, where was it? Why didn't it carry on? Well, you know, everybody's been asking what happened to the end of the story. And, you know, we're going to make that available on our website, basically, so that people can read the end of the story if they wanted to. Also, you know, I do want to enter into discussions about getting the character back up and running, because it's back in the newspaper as a reprint. But as they found with other reprints, you know, when you get to a certain point, guess what? It starts dying off again, because you've still got the old material. The Frank Bellamy stuff is fantastic. The early Martin Avesbury stuff is amazing. It's really good stuff. And he's an absolute gem of a guy. I think he went on to do storyboards for movies and does very well out of that. And he had a great storytelling ability. However, as time went on, the writers and whatever just said became convoluted, so the character didn't really have much of a substance to it. So they do need to do something that's going to reboot it at some point. And I would very much be interested in, you know, actually being part of that. The style I used for the online artwork isn't the style that I would use for the paper. I would want to go back to a more traditional line style for that. Because obviously it translates better when you put it in the newspaper. So I'm thinking something closer to the Neil Adams in line style, or at least, if not that, very sort of open line style, but certainly a lot more detailed and a lot cleaner. People have sort of referred to the work I did on Freeman, or Garth as it was in the paper then, as having a slightly Japanese influence. That has a bearing of truth in it, because I do, you know, obviously I have links to various people in Japan. But it's more along the lines of clean mucha type artwork. I like clean artwork, so I like things to have nice clear lines. And that's kind of where I went with it.
And Since you have reimagined Garth as Freeman in order to continue it in the way that you want it without editorial involvement, do you see him in a way as part of the whole tradition of characters that now that they've become public domain in a way, because we spoke before I started recording this about characters like Bulldog Drummond and Sherlock Holmes that you've integrated into your shared universe, that if something has a history, then it brings its history with it. But at the same time, with a reimagining, you have to focus on the new readers than perhaps on the past.
I'm a great believer in respecting the traditional stuff. Okay, I believe that what's gone before is always very important, and it's a great foundation to build on. One of the things that I am very passionate about is with comic books, and especially with newspaper strips, is getting kids to read them. You know, and Doctor Who's a good example of that, for instance, where you have a character that can be reimagined every time you got a new actor, but it still has a very solid basis in its universe. So when you talk about characters in, say, the adventure universe that Hyena Studio is going to be putting out, you've got Bulldog Drummond, you've got Matahari, who was a real person, but we're going to reimagine her as a, like a femme fatale type character. Bulldog Drummond was very much your politically incorrect sort of detective, spoiled, as somebody recently said, a spoiled character. You know, we've also got a couple of other characters that are originally from my own toy box, so to speak, that we're integrating into that as well. But it's all very much founded in what I call spirit of adventure. There's so many, you know, things like Clint that's come out, which aspires to be the new Eagle or 2000 AD, and quite frankly isn't. And this is my own personal feelings about this. You have fantastic artists and writers out there, and a lot of them seem to be focusing on how extreme can we take the stories. And they forget that the substance of story isn't about how extreme you make it. It's about engaging people to care about the characters. In the end, you know, if you look at something like Kick-Ass, to a point you actually like the character, but really there's not a lot to like about the character. When you look at, say, Dark Phoenix, Jean Grey, when she died, when that happened in, you know, the early 80s, people actually cried. You know, they cared about the character because a history had been built up. And one of the things that I really want to do with the stories, whether we do them as illustrated novels, or whether we do them as graphic novels, or whatever we do with what we're putting together, we really want people to feel they care about the characters. And that takes time, obviously. You know, we're building our stable up, we're building our concepts up, and we hope to be able to sort of put things out there at some point where we're all involved. You know, I've got a great team of people with me, writers, artists, colorists, all sorts of people. And whether we take it to video game or to movie or whatever we do with the characters, the one thing I'm really, really passionate about is making sure that it's accessible to not just the adults who'll have fun with it, but to the kids. Because I didn't read books like, you know, I didn't read Shakespeare because somebody put it in front of me. I read Shakespeare because I read comics first. And at the minute, we've got 9-year-old kids, 9 to 13-year-old boys are dropping between the cracks. Because they've got no heroes to aspire to. And, you know, for me, Freeman is about that. When, you know, I mean, right in the foreword of the book, it deals with that. Right the way through the whole story of the book, even though there's action, there's adventure, there's a bit of violence, there's a bit of, you know, there's a hot babe in there and things like that. That's there, but it's not in a shocking sense. Because the history of the character wouldn't have that. Yeah, you know, if you look at Frank Bellamy, he drew his wife. Every time you saw a naked chick in there, it was actually his wife. And that's fine. And Garth as a character had all those things going on. But if you go back a little bit, if you go back to some of the earlier stories in the 40s and 50s and the 60s, even though there was a little bit of titillation in there, it really was about the story and the adventure. And that's what I'm after, and that's what I want to put out there. You know, people laugh at me because I like The Mummy Returns and, you know, those movies, but I like them because
they were exciting and fun. I used to go to Saturday morning shows and watch Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and things like that. You know, I grew up on those sort of things. My Tarzan was Johnny Weissmuller. And for me, they're still with me. They're still characters that I still love. And I want to be able to do something like that with some of the characters that we're bringing out. And certainly with Freeman, it's been on a hiatus while we've been getting the studio set up. But I've already got the next six stories written out. It's just a case of putting them together now and making sure they get out there and they get published.
Yeah.
Whether I publish them on Kindle, iBook, or on paper, that's irrelevant. But they will be published.
And Garth himself, do you think is a character that's almost been neglected in a way by the British comics industry? Because if you think of some of the characters that some of the creators who have worked on the strip, I mean, I previously mentioned Peter O'Donnell and Frank Bellamy. People know Modesty Blaze, people know Dan Dare because there have been reprint books of the past adventures for years. But personally, I got into Garth because Titan Books brought out two reprint volumes in the 80s, but then no more ever came out.
I totally agree. I think that when you look at the heritage that Garth had before James Bond came out as such, he was, but you know, Garth was this secret agent. Before Doctor Who, he travelled in time. Before Dan Dare, he went into space. He's the foundation for a lot of the characters that we have now. And he has very much been neglected. It's very easy to just say, okay, let's get the best of him. So it's the Frank Bellamy, for instance. And let's put that out there and reprint it. That's easy. Creating something new with him isn't easy. You know, when I first started doing the story, there were things about it I look at now and I cringe. You know, I'm like, I could have done that so much better, and I will do it better. And you know, if I get the chance to do it as Garth, I'll do it as Garth quite happily. You know, I've got no illusions, or you know, I'm not prissy about, you know, hey, let's keep it as Freeman. You know, if I could get it back as Garth, I would. But definitely the character has been neglected, in the sense that, you know, we've had the 2000 ADs, and remember the battle in action and all the rest of it, you know, and those characters to some extent have been revived. If you look at the Paul Grist books, he's kind of stolen from just about everywhere and brought them back out in his characters. Quite obviously as well, with, you know, same name, same costume, everything. And they're wonderful. You know, it's been done very, very well. I think that a character like Garth, if it's done right, it does have a place. It can be inspiring. It can inspire kids to heroism, to excitement, to adventure. It can be like the Mummy or the Indiana Jones type feel, which is kind of the line I take with it. I'm not so bothered about the space and the time travel. That will be in there, but my feel for it is the adventure. You know, that spirit of let's get out there and try something. And boys need it now. And I think when we neglect the things that we've got in our hands, what comes after that doesn't really have much substance. So, you know, as I said, the sort of books that are coming out now, they're built on, you know, how scary, how many swear words can we put in. And they've neglected to look at the storytelling process. And they've neglected to look at the history and the love that the, you know, I mean, Frank Bellamy had an absolute love for the character, and he put a lot into it. And Titan reprinting two books is great, but you know what? There's so much more that can be done.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Not a problem.
My interview with Hugh was recorded in his studio at the London Film Museum, where he runs an art masterclass every Saturday morning. More info at www.londonfilmmuseum.com/art-masterclass.htm. And if you'd like to know more about Hugh's graphic novels Freeman and Young Sherlock Holmes, please go to www.marcosia.com. And reprints of classic installments of Garth by Frank Bellamy continue Monday to Saturday in the Daily Mirror. As it's nearly April, London-based listeners of this show have a couple of comic book festivals to look forward to. On April the 9th and 10th, Kapow is taking place at the Islington Design Centre, and its all-male list of guests includes the likes of Jonathan Ross, Mark Miller, Dave Gibbons, John Romita Jr., Kev O'Neill, and many more. Info at kapowcomiccon.com. And then on April the 23rd to May the 2nd, Sci-Fi London is taking place at various venues in the city of Westminster. And comics events include a celebration of 25 years of John Constantine, featuring creators Jamie Delano, David Lloyd, Peter Milligan and Andy Diggle talking about the character, at the Apollo Piccadilly Cinema on Lower Regent Street on Easter Saturday, and then over the first Maybank holiday weekend, April the 30th and 1st of May, a two-day comics festival, curated by yours truly, Comics at Sci-Fi London, will be taking place at the British Film Institute on the South Bank near Waterloo, and featured guests taking part in panel discussions and signings include blues singer Vivi Brown, novelists China Mieville and Denise Mina, Hannah Berry, who'll be previewing her new graphic novel, and creators from across the spectrum of small press and professional publishing, including Ian Edgington, Yuri Corey, Ilya, Zarina Liu, Alice Duke, and Hugh J. Davies. And there'll be the first opportunity to see new comics by We Are Words and Pictures, who launch Paper Science 4 at the festival, and Warren Ellis. His new comic, SVK, will be on display in a panel discussing his work, which also features footage from the new documentary, Capturing Ghosts. More info at www.panelborders.com/events. And tickets will be available shortly at www.scifilondon.com. Longer versions of today's interviews with Hugh and Richie and my previous interview with the latter can be found at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Panel Borders was recorded, edited and presented by Alex Fitch, and we'll be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.